The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, special edition, January 17th, 2018. This morning, BuzzFeed News reporters Jason Leopold and Anthony Cormier reported a story entitled "Newly Uncovered Russian Payments Are a Focus of Election Investigation." The subhead reads, U.S. authorities are poring over hundreds of newly uncovered payments from Russian diplomatic sources. Among them are transactions by former Ambassador Sergei Kislyak 10 days after the 2016 presidential election and a blocked $150,000 cash withdrawal 5 days after the inauguration. It's a story packed with fascinating reporting about financial transactions involving Russian diplomatic sources. I was joined today by one of the two reporters, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter Anthony Cormier, to discuss the story, the series of stories of which it is a part, and a path not taken by very many reporters on the Trump-Russia story, that of following the money. It's the Lawfare Podcast, special edition, Anthony Cormier on Russian wire transfers. So, Anthony, start, if you will, by just walking us through what you guys reported today, because it's actually a really complicated story that has a lot of different threads in it.
Right. So, essentially, we understand that the special counsel's office's team of investigators have for many months been looking into a series of wire transfers, cash withdrawals, deposits that were made either by Russian diplomatic employees or were sent from Russian embassy accounts. So there are hundreds and hundreds of these things dating back at least a decade. Each one of them was first flagged by Citibank, which controls the embassy accounts. And then they were tagged as suspicious. They were the genesis of a suspicious activity report, which was then sent to the Treasury Department. And the Treasury Department forwarded them to the FBI. So we've got this pool of transactions, and there are a number of ways I think you can, or if you were an investigator, you can look at them. The obvious one, the one that's most glaring that we reported sort of at the top of today's story, are two transactions by former Ambassador Sergei Kislyak, who is smack dab in the middle of the Trump-Russia investigation, in which he receives $120,000 check, actually. He takes the money, he splits it in half, and he then wires it back to an account he controls in Russia. The check was marked for payroll. Banker said we'd not seen this sort of pay structure in his account before, and the way he handled it, his immediate sort of passing it back to different accounts, is unusual. That it's an abnormal thing. So there's that one. This occurs, I think, 10 days after President Trump is elected. And then 5 days after President Trump is inaugurated, someone goes to a Citibank branch and basically asks to take out $150,000 in cash from the embassy's account. We don't know why Citibank blocked this transaction, but they did. And then subsequently referred it to the Treasury Department for further investigation. So you've got a pool of money heading straight to the ambassador, and there's no known sort of reason for him to receive it. And then you've got someone attempting to take out a bundle of cash shortly after the inauguration. These two sort of first steps are being looked at by a number of law enforcement officials. Beyond that, we reported today on basically ample ground for authorities to investigate how Russia's operatives were behaving financially in the United States. These are suspicious wire transfers that are near the Crimean referendum. They are cash deposits that bankers felt were quote structured or layered, which is a way to avoid triggering, you know, a formal alert by bankers, which means they're depositing money in very small amounts so that they don't meet the daily threshold, which is $10,000. You've got unknown uses of bonus checks. We've got about 600 wire transfers, all of which were flagged as suspicious, to a home improvement contractor who, you know, worked on Russian embassies, he says. So taken together, you've got the immediate sort of why did Ambassador Kislyak receive that money, and why did someone attempt to take $150,000 cash out of the bank so close to the election and inauguration. Beyond that are a number of threads which will allow investigators to sort of, like you said today on Twitter, to follow the money. They want to know how Russian operatives were working in the United States.
So let's talk about a number of aspects of this that are going to be on a lot of people's minds. We know that Bob Mueller is investigating these transactions, but how clear is it that these have anything to do with the larger subject matter of the Mueller investigation, that is Russian intervention in the election and possible collusion or collaboration with that intervention by people associated with Donald Trump?
Right. At the moment, we don't know. We don't know how close to the tip of the spear we are. We know from our sources that the special counsel's office has had these transactions in the investigators' hands for at least, we think, 6 to 7 months. What we don't understand is what they believe the money was used for, if they have a working theory, whether they think it directly relates to the sort of larger Trump-Russia investigation, or whether or not they are pursuing a tack that they have they've taken in sort of their past, right? We can look to other indictments, and not that these transactions will lead to any indictment, just to be fair, to satisfy my internal sort of lawyer. But we can look to past indictments to understand that they have taken a sort of broad look at Russia's behavior in the United States, particularly when you look at the indictments of Paul Manafort and Rick Gates, right? That they went and clearly relied on suspicious activity reports to fuel that part of the investigation, that they looked at him for money laundering and didn't, I don't think I'm out of line to say they didn't find any collusion, at least at the moment, right? That they went after Paul, right, basically for money laundering. And we're told that while they have no working theories to our knowledge about whether this is related to Russian interference or collusion, that they do feel like this is a good framework for them to begin to understand other potential illicit behavior by folks living in the United States.
Yeah.
I mean, shoving too long didn't read, like, we don't know. And they're not certainly offering it up to us. But I do think if you look at sort of historically how, what little history we have, to look at how the special counsel's office has operated, it makes a lot of sense that they are following the money.
So the money is a strain of investigation journalistically that, you know, a lot of people have not been that interested in. People are really interested in who met whom at Trump Tower, right? Who met with Sergei Kislyak? on what date and what did they talk about, right? But money has actually been kind of something in the somewhat in the background. And I'm interested in how you and your partner in these stories, Jason Leopold, got on this particular thread of investigative effort.
Well, I think the beauty of working at BuzzFeed News is that we tend to have to zig rather than zag. I mean, we have to go in the opposite direction because we don't simply have the firepower or the sort of institutional experience or knowledge to get at these larger investigations. And we decided that one of the oldest ways to conduct an investigation as a journalist is to quite simply follow the money. That is like the one of the most basic things to do. It is very difficult to do, and like you must understand, like this is a very, very difficult thing to do. We would not be pulling it off, you know, based on simple sourcing. These are things that are super nuanced, very complicated. But our belief remains that, for better or for worse, up or down, that if you understand how money moved hands, how it shifted from one individual to another, or one shell company to another, that you'll get a better understanding of why they're operating. I don't think it's unreasonable to believe that if you're going to understand what Russia did, somebody at some point got paid, right? Like there's nobody's doing this out of the goodness of their heart. And so we've decided as an organization, Jason and I as a team, to sink our teeth into trying to understand money flows. That if we believe that if we understand that, we'll understand perhaps in greater detail what happened in 2016. It's hard. Somebody asked me that this morning. They're like, why aren't more people pursuing this? And frankly, it's hard to do. But we're pretty confident that we're not fishing, that's a bad word, but we're sort of looking in the right corner.
And do you have a working theory of the case? Because, I mean, I read this story, as I tweeted this morning, I can reconcile it possibly with at least four different theories. So one is that these are actually all legitimate transactions, and it's just the post Trump-Russia hysteria, Citibank errs on the side of reporting everything. And so if Sergei Kislyak, you know, went to the ATM and took out $200 for his groceries, they would report that.
Well, I mean, I'll stop you there real quick. I mean, while I completely agree that these could all be, and we're reporting this, but these could be innocuous. Just because there is a suspicious activity report doesn't mean you've done anything wrong. But I will say our understanding of what Citi did and how Treasury has passed along to the FBI is that they're not flagging his normal bank. These aren't, he took out 20 bucks to, you know, hop on the metro, or he, you know, bought dinner at McDonald's or wherever he prefers to eat. Those sort of things are not part of what Citibank has flagged.
Okay, but you agree that that it's possible that in the current environment they are somewhat over-reporting anything they can't explain.
I absolutely believe that 100%.
Okay,
absolutely. So you are 10-4. Yep.
Possibility number one: transactions all legitimate. They just look weird because we don't understand what they are.
And Citi's under an obligation to report them, and they are what they are. That's it. That is absolutely right. That could be one of the, you know, tent poles here.
So second possibility is it's pretty garden variety Putin corruption. That is, we know this is a kleptocracy, and kleptocracies have to get money to the people they're going to pay off and wire transfers. And you got to do that through the banking system. And so what you're actually seeing here is graft.
Right. That was suggested to us by numerous former intelligence. In fact, it's one of the first things they brought up was, look, this is I'm going to quote a source here, but essentially they called Russia a mafia state, and this is a wide-ranging kleptocracy, and this is how kleptocracies operate. They've got to move money all across the world. It may have absolutely nothing to do with their interference or their investigations, but this is normal, sort of run-of-the-mill graft and corruption. That is definitely distinctly a possibility that sources have raised with us.
Okay.
Which remains sort of, to be fair, our understanding is that remains an important area of inquiry for the special counsel.
Interesting. Okay, so third possibility is that it in fact does reflect intelligence operations, mm-hmm. but that they're intelligence operations that may have nothing to do with what everybody else calls Trump Russia and I call L'Affaire Russe. That is, it dates back quite a ways. You've reported on here hundreds of transactions that date back to, 5 years ago.
Right.
And so maybe you've picked up a significant set of intelligence operations. They're just not the ones about interfering with the U.S. electoral system.
Absolutely. I think if you read carefully, your readers will take a look carefully. They'll find a series of transactions in 2014 that Citibank flagged as being suspicious because about 30 checks, all in the same amount, all from the same entity, are sent to a couple of dozen embassy officials, military attachés. They're cashed immediately, and they fall within a very specific time frame. And Citibank says, we find this a little suspicious because this was right in the middle of one of Putin's, sort of strongest pushes during the Crimean referendum. So, I mean, it could be, and this is a source that suggested us, it could be evidence of different intelligence operations, just not the one that that America cares the most about right now. So I think, yep, that's another distinct possibility.
So possibility number four, which is presumably the reason that Bob Mueller is interested in this stuff, is that some or all of these transactions actually have something to do with the core matter within his investigative mandate. Do you, and to me, when I look at it with that possibility in mind, the most interesting set of transactions involves the very large amount of money that goes to this small home improvement contractor in the neighborhood of the Russian embassy over a period of time. And if you look at that and the money to Kislyak, it is consistent with an intelligence service arranging for kind of funding mechanisms for kind of walking around money. I'm interested in any insight you might have on what do we think Mueller's interest in these transactions are? Is it just due diligence about everything financial, or do you think that there's a specific theory that connects this with the Russia matter?
I do, and I'm not at liberty to report it right now. So as you can imagine, we spent the bulk of this morning on the telephone with sources. And there is a working theory as it relates particularly to the Kislyak transactions and the attempted withdrawal of money that relates directly to the core matter. They are hesitant to even remotely broach it on the record, on the record. But there are specific tasks, specific lines of inquiry that the special counsel's office or the people that it is working with have taken as it relates to these. We know from really reliable individuals who have firsthand knowledge of how this is unfolding that they're keen to know about the Kislyak transactions and the $150,000 as it relates to Kislyak's sort of conversations with administration officials, with his interactions. There's a reason we talked earlier about a lot of people, many journalists are interested in meetings. Those are really important. The investigators, our reporting tells us the investigators are beyond due diligence. They have very specific thoughts on what this could have been used for, and they're running it down as hard as humanly possible.
All right,
I'm sorry, so, I can't be. I don't mean to be vague.
No, no, I understand.
Okay, cool.
Things that are unreported are unreported for a reason.
Yeah, for now. I mean, you know, we work real hard.
So, one of the things that has interested me about the stream of reporting that you guys have been doing since right around the time of the Manafort indictment was that you are pretty unusual among reporters working in this space in referring in story after story to active law enforcement sources. Most, and I have written about this, most reporters who are working in this area are sourcing things in a fashion that feels to me most consistent with getting a lot of information from the defense bar, a fair bit of information from the Capitol Hill investigations. In all of these stories, you guys are referring specifically to law enforcement sources. And in this story, you're referring to three of them. And, you know, I am interested in, I don't want to ask reporters about their sources, and I'm not going to start now.
Nope.
But I'm interested in the methodological difference between the way you guys are reporting and the way a bunch of other people are reporting. And just, so talk to me about the streams of information that are driving this story. You clearly have access to suspicious activity reporting that goes to the Treasury Department from banks. So tell us a little bit about what is a suspicious activity report, who files it, and under what circumstances and to whom.
Sure. So essentially, a suspicious activity report, a SAR, for lack of a better word, is a report from the bank to the Treasury's financial crime, basically. And these things swim upstream, you know, like salmon, you know, like they, thousands of them come across Treasury's desk every day. And so what they've tried to do, they've tried to set up various alerts within their own internal system so that if you think that it meets some thresholds for potential drug trafficking or elder abuse or kleptocracy or money laundering, that Treasury's got a system to be able to very quickly pluck those reports from the banks out. And in this case, I can share that many of these threads have come from the Treasury Department's and Citibank, to be fair, their reporting on kleptocracy. That the FBI is keenly interested in how kleptocracy works. And so our understanding is that a lot of these transactions were initially flagged in relation to potential foreign corruption or kleptocracy. How do I do this without even coming close to touching on sources? I can say that, like, when we are reporting that we are talking to officials with knowledge of the inquiry, we mean that they have direct knowledge of the inquiry. Where we say that we have reviewed things, we have actually put our eyes on them. We're trying, because of the current climate, we're trying to not solely rely on one stream of information or another. I certainly can report that we have multiple sources across multiple U.S. law enforcement agencies that feel the information, the road that we've taken, is very, very important, and the public deserves to know more about it.
And
go ahead.
And you have also reported, and I thought this was interesting, because when your last story came out on these, on a sort of earlier iteration of this, you and Jason got some criticism for overblowing the matter. And
right.
I was interested when I read this story to see that one group of people that took that, seemed to have taken that story pretty seriously, was the Senate Intelligence Committee investigation,
yes,
which turned around and requested a bunch of the a bunch of information about the transactions that you were reporting at the time.
Right.
So tell us a little bit about that earlier story and what the criticism you got for it and how the Senate Intelligence Committee responded to it. Bring us up to date on that.
Right. So I think it was a couple of months ago that we reported a series of wire transfers from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the Russian MFA, to its various embassies across the globe, including the one in the United States, were marked actually in the memo line, literally written in the memo line, was that the money was to be used to, quote, finance the election campaign of 2016. We were criticized for overhyping the story. It wasn't our intention. We very flatly said, look, these are part of they're currently being investigated by the FBI, which remains to be true. What happened was is that these funds went to our embassy and to 50-something, 60-something others, about $380,000. And it was September-ish 2016. And as soon as we reported it, of course, we went to the MFA and to the embassy a million times and asked them for comment. They refused to speak to us. And as soon as we published, they said, you guys are a bunch of goobers. You guys are actually truly, quote, propagandists, and that this money was used to basically set up polling places for Russians living abroad so that they could vote in the Duma election. We were, as you once said, much maligned for that story. I think a lot of the public said, well, yeah, duh, you know, it's definitely not for what we think it is. It's got to be for the Duma. And we said, okay, well, our sources, who we trust and who are reliable, who have not steered us wrong, have said no, that they don't believe that's true. They never said that they thought this was anything that had anything to do with the Trump-Russia investigation. They said there is something unusual, suspicious about them that they remain, you know, sort of critical to understanding. And our sources have continued to reaffirm that prior to the publication of this story. And we also know that the Senate Intelligence Committee has requested those exact documents. I can say that I don't think the Senate Intel Committee is sitting around Googling who to make requests on next. That's not my understanding. Those are professionals over there, and you know they have a good idea of what they're doing. And again, our sources are. We had a source tell us that in a year from now, you'll know what that money was used for, and we remain keen to know that. Again, not making any allegations. It could be totally, perfectly legitimate, and American intelligence officers could be way out over their skis on this. But what we're hearing right now from people actively involved in these inquiries is that there's more to it. Take a breath. We want to understand exactly what happened behind the scenes, and this is part and parcel of a larger inquiry. Yeah, that was a fun day, Ben. That was a good time.
So, where do you go from here? It seems to me that you have. I think this story shows. I actually thought that the previous two stories were pretty interesting and pretty compelling, but I have been interested that this follow the money thread has not gained particular traction in the larger press corps that's interested in the Trump-Russia stuff. And I think this story, I suspect, is opening a bunch of people's eyes because I think it's a pretty dramatic breakthrough in a lot of ways. And I'm interested, you know, what the reaction to it has been among other, you know, reporters that you know. And you know, are people sort of saying, wait a minute, are we... Is this a road we should be going down now, or is this one in which you guys are still pretty much on your own?
You know, it's hard for me to tell. I mean, if I was an assigning editor or if I was somebody who was responsible for this, I might want to know more about how the money operated. I think that's not a. I mean, that's a reasonable question, regardless of what we were reporting, right? I mean, they're thin. You know, our intelligence agencies are correct, and we have no reason to believe that they're not, that there was interference. Somebody had to get paid for it, right? People don't do that out of the goodness of their heart. If you hack someone, you're getting paid to do it. So it's long been our sort of thought that, well, let's see if we can find out how that worked. I will say that I was surprised after the indictments of Paul Manafort and Rick Gates that more journalists didn't attempt to try to look at how money flowed.
Okay, so let's pause there because I actually think there's a really interesting process point. So I don't have the story in front of me or the indictment in front of me, but my recollection is that you guys, just a very small number of days before the Manafort indictment, you wrote a story that identified, I believe it was 13 or 15 specific wire transfers involving Manafort, all of which specifically then showed up in the indictment. Is that is my memory accurate?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. We had 13, same exact deal we had right here. These were transactions that were flagged by bankers as suspicious, sent to the Treasury Department, and then forwarded on to the FBI.
So
we had and each one of those we actually published, I think, on a Saturday, and then he was indicted on Monday. Those were sort of the framework. All of those were led to his ultimate indictment. Interestingly, many of those transactions went to home improvement companies. We reported again today about transfers of payments to home improvement companies. So it's that's one of the earliest attempts by the organization to look at money flow.
So broadly speaking, you feel pretty vindicated at this point for a focus on this stuff.
No, I mean, it's not really. I never really felt like I needed to win other journalists' approval. All I cared about was our source, getting the story right, right? And our sources, the people closest to this investigation, said, yeah, you guys got it right. Don't listen to anything on the outside. Don't get too far over your skis. We've been hyper, hyper cognizant. As you can imagine, there are tons of things that we have not been able to report yet. And so we've sort of never really listened, at least I don't talk on the internet. I don't really do Twitter too much or Facebook. I'm just the regular dude who works his tail off and investigates like hell. So it wasn't really a thing for me. It was tough on Jason, you know, he's a pretty internet savvy dude. And we came to the conclusion that, look, we have a really unique path. We have reliable sourcing. We know what we're doing. We understand how money flows and how it moves and what it looks like and why it's deemed suspicious and why it's flagged. And once it's flagged, where does it go? We understand that world, and we're fairly convinced that when this is all put to bed, good, bad, or ugly, however it winds up, that the special counsel's office and the multiple sort of investigative bodies are looking into it are going to explain to the American public what actually happened financially. I do firmly believe that
this body of material will be part of the answer to the question that everyone's asking.
Right. Yes, even if there is collusion or if there is none, that this work will eventually help them solve the riddle.
Anthony, you guys are pursuing a really interesting line of inquiry. I have been really engaged by it, and it's made me think about a whole bunch of aspects of the investigation. And I hope you stay on it and keep working on it.
Brilliant, man. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for joining us. The Lawfare Podcast is produced, as always, in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Hey, people, if you're one of those who hops in to listen to the Lawfare Podcast on our special editions, please take the time to promote the Lawfare Podcast by rating us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever podcast distribution services you use. We don't do any advertising of the Lawfare Podcast. We don't promote it by any means other than word of mouth and occasional tweets from people like me. It really helps when we also get tweets from people like you. So tweet the Lawfare Podcast, share it on Facebook, talk about it over dinner, make yourself annoying about it. Tell people about this wonderful experience you had learning about Russian wire transfers by listening to, you know, this jerk Benjamin Wittes talk to the reporter Anthony Cormier. Spend some time educating the world about the Lawfare podcast. And as always, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.